Match of my life. Life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.
Okay, today's guest on Match of My Life is the one consistent for Liverpool Football Club since 1971. Wow, who can lay claim to that? His sound is known by most Liverpool fans, I'd say 99.9% of them. He's the sound of the stadium, the voice of Anfield, George Sefton. Morning to you, George.
Good morning.
Great to see you. What a CV to have. The sound of Liverpool for all those decades.
Yeah, I get called worse, but that's nice to have you. There are a lot of people still who think I'm sort of computer generated. You know, you remember Max Headroom on the TV years ago? People, even now, I'll be going up in the lift in the Kenny Dalglish stand on a match day, and I'll be talking to somebody, and the people standing next to me will be staring at me, said, "You're George, aren't you?" And they're looking, and I do not sound like I look. I know that for a fact. It's a really strange phenomenon. I don't know what they're expecting, but you know, they get a shock every time.
People do recognise you as well, though.
Oh, yes.
When you're walking into the ground. You've had a bit.
Since the advent of LFC TV, and that's... Since then, for the last two years or so, I've suddenly become very popular on the continent of Europe. I've had a queue of people making little documentaries about me, and I had a couple of French journalists over doing it. Germans. There's a big movie in Germany which we're hoping to get released, I think, about the history of You'll Never Walk Alone, which I'm in. Which I've got quite a big chunk of, and I believe I'm a big star over there now, but I just wish to get it released over here. It's quite a fascinating film. But you know, the killer punch was before the Derby match in the FA Cup a couple of weeks ago. I walked into the Home Bay Cafe for a coffee before, and Stan Collymore was there. He grabbed me, had a TV film crew with him. And when we swap cards, it turns out he's now working for Russia Today. So now my face is all over.
You've gone global, George.
Yes,
gone global. You're just about everywhere. How honoured do you feel to have such a close association with Liverpool Football Club?
Unbelievable. I mean, going back to the time I was a kid standing in the car park watching the players go in and getting autographs. And I say to people that even now, just walking through the front door, instead of queuing up to go and sit on the terrace, is just surreal. It gets weirder as the time goes by. It's amazing.
It still doesn't feel natural. You've been given a golden ticket each game.
Absolutely.
Well, just tell us about your upbringing then. Where were you from, and what was the connection with Liverpool?
I was born in Oxford Street Hospital, like my three kids were, strangely. I lived in Walton, near Walton Hospital, and I was brought up as a Red. My dad was a big strapping centre-forward when he was a kid. He had a trial for Liverpool in 1923, would you believe? Didn't get anywhere, sadly. But I was brought up as a Red, and then my dad was strange. He's been dead 50 years this year. That just hit me recently, but he wasn't one of these dads who took his lad to the match. He used to go off to the match. That was his territory.
Leave you at home.
Leave me at home. And I'd be waiting for him to come home and tell me what the score was. And he burst through the door.
No way of keeping track?
No, not in those days. It's it's just insane when you think about it now. But when I was, 12-ish, I started going to the match with school friends and whatever. And that was, I started going about a fortnight after Bill Shankly got the job, strangely. It was just pure coincidence. And
what did Bill Shankly mean to you in your mind as a young Liverpool fan?
Well, obviously, when I started going, he just arrived, and he didn't know what you were in for. And it was, the Shankly legend grew over the years. And obviously, looking back now, he came to Liverpool on a mission. I say in that film, Shankly's The Nature's Fire, that there was a feeling around the place that the powers that be at Anfield in those days were quite happy being a big fish in a small pond, i.e. near the top of the second division. We had a couple of years where we were nearly promoted and didn't quite make it, and then everything fell into place, and the rest, as they say, is history, onwards and upwards. And Shanks, he had unlimited ambitions for the club. He wanted them to be champions of Europe, and thank God he lived long enough to see that happen, although he wasn't in charge, obviously, when it happened. But I always say that Shankly built the train and everybody else was a stand-in driver, Bob Paisley, Joe Fagan, all the way down to what we've got now.
Who'd have thought your paths would cross as well? And yes. I know there's a lovely little story, isn't there, where you were a little bit worried about how Shanks might have reacted you going on the microphone.
Yes, everybody has a Shankly story. This was the early 70s when Leeds were looking like they were going to win the league. Huddersfield Town were looking like they were going to get relegated. Mm. And one night we had a youth cup match at Anfield, and Peter Robinson rang through to me, said Huddersfield are beating Leeds 1-0. He said, we get a break in play, give the score out. So I did, and there was a big cheer around the ground, and we carried on. Then halfway through the second half, Peter rings me again and said, Leeds are winning now. I'm not sure it was 2 or 3-1. He said, you better give that score out in the interest of fairness if there's a break in play. So I did, and never thought any more about it until the end of the game. I go downstairs to give my keys in, and the girl on the desk in reception, she said, Leggett. I said, pardon? He said, Shanks is after you. What?
And your blood went cold.
Yes, absolutely. And I said, what's up? He said, they came in. You ruined the atmosphere. Ruined the atmosphere. Where is he? So this would be a Wednesday night, midweek. And on the following Saturday, we had a home match. And I wandered into the ground. And who's the first person I bump into? Shankly. And of course, my blood runs cold again. And he just looked at me, morning, son. And that was it. Off he went. No, he'd forgotten all about the Wednesday night. It's just the way he was.
He was one of those whose emotions got up for something and then it was passed.
Absolutely. I always say about one thing makes me very sad about Bill Shankly, that when he retired from football, he didn't go into politics because the whole world would be different by now. There'd be no hassle. He just would have sorted everybody out. Nobody got in his way. He was just so focused and dedicated, and he had to meet the man to appreciate it. Charismatic doesn't come close.
The perfect diplomat. Absolutely. Right, people probably think, how did George end up behind the microphone at Anfield? Was it a job interview? Was he spotted in media? What was the path to becoming the voice of Anfield back in 1971?
Well, early in 71, I was at the match one night with my wife, standing in the paddock, and there was a guy on the PA then, who I didn't know at the time, was standing in for the regular guy.
That was Alan Jackson, wasn't it?
Jackson.
So Alan was your predecessor.
That's right.
Before that, it was a Stuart Bateman.
That's it, that's Stuart, yes. He was the one who started it off as soon as they built a PA system. But Alan had gone off to Manx Radio. He was desperate to get into radio. He was offered this six-month contract, and he left his pal in charge. And this one night I was standing there, this guy had made a couple of bloomers. And he said something silly, and I said to my wife, oh, dear, this is embarrassing for the club. And my wife didn't bat an eyelid. She just looked at me and said, you couldn't do any better. I said, well, actually. And I went home, and I wrote to Peter Robinson. Goodness knows what possessed me to this day.
What did the letter say?
Basically, it was very long and complex, but it boiled down to dear sir, giz a job. I can do that. And I was sort of going on about I've supported the club for since I could walk, and I'm not too keen on the present guy doing that and whatever. I wish I'd kept the letter, but the next thing I know, I get a letter from Peter Robinson, come and see me. And apparently they decided to, at the end of the season, to change things. And they were thinking where to turn, and my letter landed on Peter's desk, and he thought, well, he can speak English, he's articulate, we'll get him in and see if he's got two heads. And they wanted somebody who could keep his head in a crisis, I think, rather than a high-powered DJ, which I wasn't. But
you were given the job straight away.
Yeah.
It was a case of have a go. And there's something very different than thinking, oh, I can do that job.
Oh, yeah,
and then all of a sudden being handed the job of stadium announcer.
Yeah, can I just say, don't try this at home, folks. there are people, there is a queue. But, I suddenly found myself, first day of season 71-72, up on the TV gantry with a box of records. Remember those old round things? You're not old enough to remember vinyls.
Oh, I do. I do.
I wonder now.
What's the first record you played, George?
I think it was Maggie May by Rod Stewart. I wouldn't swear. I know I certainly played it. I'm not sure it was the first one, but I had my entire record collection with me, and I've been borrowing records off people in work all week to make sure I had enough to last for a couple of hours. And I got onto the old TV gantry, you remember, at the roof of the main stand.
Which was precarious to get onto.
Yes, it was fun and games.
Down a ladder and a...
Oh, tell me about it. It was all right unless there was a storm brewing or something. That was quite fun. But actually, the worst scenario was one night we were playing Portsmouth in the League Cup. And when I got out at the end... Remember they used to throw confetti on the pitch, that gang? There was confetti everywhere, and they were a bit disgruntled on the way out, so they set fire to it all. So I had to battle my way through this cloud of thick black smoke to get out. I thought I was done for a couple of minutes there. But as you say, it was quite fun and games getting up there. But I got up to the main stand, the TV gantry, and got to that little ladder at the top, and I'm looking around and thinking, what the blue blazes am I doing here?
What have I done?
And I gritted my teeth. I thought, I've either got to go down there and get on with it, or go home and pack a bag and move to London or the continent or somewhere, because nobody will ever speak to me again. So I did. I just took a deep breath, and away you go. And
crowds were big then as well. I mean, we talked about mid-50s. Now, was it 60? 60,000?
The 56,000 was the biggest crowd we had in. That was my first season, Roger Hunt's testimonial. Normally it was, the crowds were around 50,000, around the same as we get now, to be honest. But the biggest crowd of that season was 56,002. I remember it very well, and that was Roger's testimonial at the end of the game. And that was a crazy night. That was amazing.
Today's Match of My Life guest is George Sefton, the voice of Anfield. Plenty more to come from George, including his favourite match of all time. You're with Radio City Talk.
Match of My Life. Life stories and greatest games. Radio City Talk.
Match of My Life guest today is George Sefton. He's been in the announcer's box at Anfield since 1971. He's witnessed 11 league championships, 5 European Cups, 6 FA Cups, 8 League Cups, and many other days that have put smiles on fans' faces as well. We mentioned the first game you did, August the 14th, 1971, Liverpool against Forest, Kevin Keegan's debut.
Yeah.
So you felt slightly sort of in the shadow of bit of greatness arriving.
Yeah, at the time, he was some, I was going to say scruffy young lad, that's not right, but he was wet behind the ears, I think is a good expression. He was rough around the edges, but nobody had ever heard of him. Obviously, and this, I remember somebody saying over my shoulder, that new kid's a bit of a tiger, who is he? And we paid £35,000 to Scunthorpe for him, and he hit the ground running, and no mistake, he just tore the Forest to shreds single-handed. It was an absolutely amazing debut, and of course that was the icing on the cake as far as I was concerned.
Hey, £35,000 for him, and you were getting £2.50 a match.
That's right.
Something's not right there, George.
I need a new PR. And I was grateful for it as well.
Things have changed in terms of responsibilities, but back then were you reading the team sheet out?
Oh yes, I was doing everything.
Right, so what was your full role on a match day when you started?
Much the same as it is now, except that somebody else reads the team sheet out. My job was to basically play music and entertain the crowds for a couple of hours before the game.
Choose your own music?
Oh, yes.
One told you?
Yeah. No. People have tried over the years just to drop hints here and there, but I...
Still the case, is it? Does George choose his own music?
Yes. I do get, how shall I say, occasional input. And to this day, I mean, obviously the biggest thing that's changed over the years is the advent of social media. I have a regular conversation with various people, just over, you know, occasionally over the social media. Why do you play that rubbish? Okay. When they say that rubbish, they mean something I don't like, forgetting that there's another 54,000 people there who are quite happy with what I'm playing. And I always go through the same rigmarole. Okay, what would you like me to play? And 99 times out of 100, I won't get a response to that. The flummox, I don't know. Or the other regular conversation is, I thought you were going to play such and such on Saturday. Yes, I did. About 20-3. Oh, and these people turn up.
They've missed it.
They've missed it. And there are a lot of people who think I play a couple of tunes at halftime. And I'd say, I've got, you know, I have always had a couple of hours' worth before the game. Mm. Nowadays, there's very few people when the gates open. There are people who like to come in, sit and read the programme cover to cover and listen to me. But going back
to... Did people used to get in far earlier, did they?
Oh, yes, they had to.
It was far more of an occasion for the hour before.
Yeah, but don't forget, they had to. In the 70s, if you wanted to get on the cop, you got there, you paid your cash at the gate and hoped to get in. I know there were once or twice I was locked out. Not when I was working there, obviously, but before that, I trundled back down Anfield Road in bits because I couldn't get in, which was devastating. But, you know, in the 70s, when we were Liverpool and Leeds were up against each other for the championship, they'd open the gates at, I don't know, midday, 12:30 sometimes for a 3 o'clock kickoff. And I'd get to 3 o'clock and I'd slump back in my seat. I was shattered.
You'd been properly worked.
I'd been really at it. And obviously the noise is on top of you all the time, solid for three hours before the game. It's quite something. But nowadays, everybody who turns up to the match has got a little piece of paper in their pocket that says, you're going to get in, you're going to go in this stand, you're going to sit in that seat. They don't have to worry about it. So they think, well, I'm not sitting in the cold. I'll go in this nice pub here or the lounge in the main stand or the nice bars and the street food and all the rest of it. They don't have to get in until very nearly time, although they will pile in time, for you'll never walk alone. I know my younger son, who's now in his 40s, he doesn't go to the match very much anymore. He's got wife and kids and whatever, but he was notorious. He, wherever he was, he used, whichever pub he was in, he plunked down in his seat at the opening bars. You could never walk alone every Saturday. And I used to say to him, did he like so-and-so, so-and-so? And one night he was going out to a gig in Manchester with his mates. I said, who are you going to see? He said, nobody you've heard of. I said, try me. He said, Lemon Jelly. I said, I've been playing their new single for the last 6 weeks. I got a promo copy. And he's looking at me mortified. I said, well, if you get your backside out of the pub, and come and listen to your old dad for once.
You've got your finger on the pulse with the kidders. What you are very good at is promoting Liverpool music as well. Yeah. Is that important to you personally?
It's very important to me. When I was 11 and 12 at school, the rules were that if it was raining at lunchtime, you got a book and went and sat in the big hall, right? My pal and I couldn't be bothered doing that. We used to slope off down to the basement and we went and sat in the one of the science lecture rooms and we listened to these big lads practicing the chords on their guitars. One was called George Harrison. Another one was called Paul McCartney. And that taught me a valuable lesson that, great oaks from little acorns grow. So I every you know, band, artist, I hear, I like to think I can help push them along the way. One or two people, you know, the Zootons and the Coral and people like that, I was the first person to play them in to any sort of size audience. Mm. I'm very proud of that. I know they've said something along those lines over the years. One or two bands who didn't quite make it. I know one particular band there. Was it the Sound of Guns? They got a record contract off me playing at Anfield because there was
wow.
a record producer in the audience and said, "Who's that?" And tracked them down and signed them up. But even so, even if they don't go any further, the sheer pride of hearing their music played at Anfield, you know, that must be a wonderful experience for a young band. And I try my best, although it's very difficult. There's so much talent around this city. You know, every week I'll hear something. Where have you been? Why aren't you a big star? Why aren't you on the Palladium or, you know, the O2 Arena or the Echo Arena or whatever? And the answer is because the market is just so crowded now.
But it's the power and the influence of what you actually have to do on match day.
Absolutely.
It's amazing, really.
You know, I'm the antidote to Simon Cowell, so I'll have to look myself.
Go the other way.
The modern-day John Peel.
What was it like introducing those names in the 70s from your Keegans, your Faircloughs, your Soonesses, your Dalgleishes?
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, as I said to you before, I am still basically deep down a Liverpool fan. And you're reading these names out.
Did you have a particular style of reading them out or not?
Not particularly. I'm crisp and clear, I think, is right. it. I don't go in for the shouty bits. I don't like that. I really don't like that. I know people argue with me about somebody referred to me on social media recently, an Everton fan, I have to say, as that drone at Anfield. I said, thank you. Yeah, but that's me. I'm sorry. I'm too late to change.
Well, everyone can't like you, George. It's only like us on the radio.
Yeah,
you take the good with the bad, don't you?
Yeah, I take the view, when the greater majority of people are happy with the playlist and whatever, I just plough on. Mm. And when they're not, I'll just say thanks, bye, and off we go. It'll happen. I mean, you know, I keep saying to people, people say, well, you know, you'll have to keep going, Joe. I say, well, I will until I'm going to drop down dead one day. And I'm more likely, you know, during a 95th minute penalty, you know, I'll be having my coronary than anything else. But at the moment, I'll just plough on.
You like me, worked with the wonderful Phil Easton. Phil,
yes,
very good
absolutely.
Friend. In fact, we're in the Phil Easton studio to it. And at one point in your career, you thought your time was up, didn't you, as Anfield announcer?
It was.
Phil's an absolute gentleman, but I think at one stage he'd been told to go in and work alongside you, but
he'd been told to go in and replace me.
Right.
I was, I'd been shown the door, except nobody had bothered to tell me. And Phil turned
up. Football politics.
Yeah, Phil turned up at Anfield, walked into the matchday control room, and said, what are you doing here? And I said, I was about to ask you the same question. And he was mortified. I was mortified. It was just a complete lack of communication. But in the end, it was decided that we should work as a team, which we did. People used to think I hated Phil. I thought the world of the guy.
Oh, yeah, he was a gent.
He was an absolute star.
Absolute gem. But again, that forged that format of you doing the stuff up in the box and Phil doing the pitch side
that's
stuff.
That's right. I used to say, I do all the work, you get all the glory. You get on the TV.
You'd had your years of glory, George.
Yeah. But it's weird. But as I say, this is season 47. I'd like to think I'd see 50.
Right.
But, you know, after that, I think I might go and, you know, put my feet up and watch a bit of daytime TV and nothing else. But you never know.
It'd be hard to pull away from it. I mean, how many games have you missed in 47 years?
I tried counting recently. I've only missed one in the last 25 years. That was my son got married down in Crawley during the season. I was fuming. But he told me about 12 months previously. And when the fixtures came out in June 2008, I said to my wife, hopefully we're away that weekend. Mm. Or if we're not away, if we're playing Chelsea or United or whatever, they'll move it to the Sunday. Of course, we weren't. We were playing Wigan Athletic at home, so I missed the match. Before that, we're going back to 1993, I missed a couple of midweek games because I was working in Boreham Wood.
But it really irks you, doesn't it, to miss a game?
Oh, it did. Yeah. But before that again, I missed one in 1974, which was a testimonial match for, I think it was Ron Yeats. We had it was a week after the, 10 days after the cup final, because a week after the cup final, I was set up on up in Kirby, and I was in several pieces in Walton Hospital having my jaw stitched back together. So I missed that game.
Few and far between.
I say about half a dozen over the years.
Right, you've got a really important function to do during a match. Then obviously you do it with the great Peter as well, yeah. Peter McDowell. Yeah, yeah. Now, just how important has timing become, particularly for something like "You'll Never Walk Alone"?
It's critical now. It's because apart from the we have a running order now. We never used to. Everything's changed. I think I was told it was Rafa who decided to move "You Never Walk Alone" later in the proceedings. So now I play "You Never Walk Alone" at the stroke of the last handshake.
That is the signal.
That is the signal.
Shake hands, play.
Yeah, and you've got the trouble.
Ever so occasionally it might merge into the start of the game.
Well, that's the problem. The rules are that I believe that the teams have got to be out on the pitch 4 minutes before kickoff. Then they troop out, line up. I play that Premier League handshake anthem, which lasts for 44 seconds. Then "You Never Walk Alone," which lasts for 2 minutes 38 seconds. So if the teams come out late, I mean, it did happen once or twice, they came out 3 minutes before kickoff. "You Never Walk Alone" is still going on. And the referee kicks off. Once or twice it's happened, the referees have done the decent thing or waited till it's finished before they kick off. But nowadays they're getting leaned on by TV and whatever, so they kick off on time. So
it's out of your hands, George.
It is,
you can't do anything with it.
No, but I'm the one who gets the earache when it all goes wrong, guaranteed.
George Shefton doing his Match of My Life. He talks about "You'll Never Walk Alone." We'll talk about one of the greatest "You'll Never Walk Alones," which is his pick for his Match of My Life, and we'll do that next.
Match of My Life. Life stories and greatest games. Radio City Talk.
Voice of Anfield, George Shefton, doing his Match of My Life today. Let's get on to the game in question. George has done how many decades of football matches at Anfield?
Lots.
So he's seen
your
St Etienne's and everything else.
Yeah.
But what is the one game for you, George?
It has to be the Champions League semi-final against Chelsea in 2005.
2005. So yeah. We'll get on to that game in just a second. Yeah. If you had to do a top three, would St Etienne come
into
that?
St Etienne obviously is in the
atmosphere for that one.
The atmosphere was fantastic. I remember the St Etienne game. I was working at the Manchester Evening News at the time, so I had to do all sorts of loops and whistles, some real Starsky and Hutch driving to get through the crowds to park and get in. Nearly didn't get in. But the atmosphere that night was amazing. And obviously there was people had the feeling creeping over that we could possibly go on and do this. And then obviously we were on the way out of the competition. Then David Fairclough comes on and puts
you introduce
back.
Super Sub.
Super Sub. Well, he hates being called Super Sub.
That's his book.
Yeah,
that's his life story.
I'm very sorry. I know. But getting, just getting through that, the way it all happened, and that was just an hysterical night at Anfield.
You got to pick one other one?
Probably the, in the Europa League season before last, when we beat
Borussia Dortmund.
Borussia Dortmund.
Right.
That was a fantastic game. If that game had gone to 95 minutes, we would have won about 10-3, I think. It was just, they just couldn't keep us out. It was amazing to watch, and I just I think if they can recreate that form ever again, we'll conquer the world.
It's interesting how there's three European
games
there.
I mean, the European ones. Yeah, the European ones are the big occasions. You know, the glamour, the midweek floodlights, the row. People probably, some of them will notice, I turn the volume up good style for Europeans. It's just part of the environment. I turn the sound
on the Champions League theme music, or you'll never walk alone.
The whole shooting match, all the tub thumping music that comes beforehand, because the crowd have to just sing that little bit louder to get over me, and it works every time. If the crowd's up for it, and obviously the match has got to go right, so you need.
But the Chelsea match had something extremely special, particularly about how You'll Never Walk Alone was. Yes. And I have to say, it is the greatest atmosphere I've ever experienced
If you go onto Google and look for the best ever rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone, you can see there's one clip, it's the end of that game, because one clip, it includes the bit where I announced the 6 minutes added time, and you can... You know, the camera goes to Rafa and he's looking up and looking at the board and looking at this 6 minutes. And further down, you know, there's the blessed Jose turning to his coaching staff, 6 minutes. And he's screaming at his team to get stuck in. And people say that Chelsea threw everything but the kitchen sink at Liverpool. I say, well, there was a kitchen sink flying through the air at one stage. How we got through that 6 minutes, I do not know, but we did. And then, final whistle, I just banged You'll Never Walk Alone on, at the top of the volume. And at the end again of that, you can hear me. I'd lost it by then. I was giving this speech. It sounded very like one of Hitler's rallies in Nuremberg. What I said was quite true. It was the best atmosphere I'd ever experienced in all my years of going to Anfield. And by that time, I would have been going to Anfield for nearly 50 years. You know, it was just amazing. And it wasn't just, again, it wasn't just the result. I mean, I still think our goal might have been dodgy. We didn't have VAR or, you know, but I don't care.
It's almost better if it was isn't it?
Yes, that's what I always say, because you remember Chelsea had beaten us in the League Cup final, and that was what turned me off Mr. Mourinho, because when all that business of him putting his finger to his lips and going shh, 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 and he said he was doing it to the press boys. He wasn't. He was looking me in the eye at the time. My wife and I were sat behind the dugout, and he was looking directly into the red section, and that really got to me.
So that League Cup final, he was telling you to shush.
He was telling
telling
Liverpool
your
fans,
section to shush.
But what the other thing about nobody realises about that 2005 night, for me personally, it was such a landmark, because we hadn't been in a European Cup final, which turned into the Champions League, since 1985, since Heysel. Now, I thought we'd never get back in the big final after Heysel. I really did. I thought,
And you'd been at Heysel,
I was in the middle of everything at Heysel. But the other thing, on the way out to Heysel, I went on the plane with the office staff and the reserve players. And at the airport, my wife and my eldest came to see me off. And Peggy Higby, who was in charge of the ticket office in those days, I don't know if you remember Peggy, but she, looking over my shoulder at my son, and said, "Oh, are you going with your dad?" And he said, "No." And he was 12. I never thought of taking him, but all his mates had been with Everton the previous week to Rotterdam, and he was really upset that, he wasn't getting taken off to this big final. And I looked at him, I said, "I promise you, next year, you'll go." Of course, 20 years come and go, and all of a sudden we're in the European final. After all these years, the stupid thing was, in the end, neither he nor I went.
To Istanbul.
Couldn't get tickets. People said to me, "What do you mean?" I said, "I didn't get a ticket." My other son went and my daughter went. They had season tickets at Anfield, but my eldest and I didn't go. But so 2 years later in Athens, we just went. I didn't go to anywhere near anybody at the club after tickets. I got planes and hotels organised and
got tickets elsewhere.
We got tickets elsewhere. A friend of my other son was going out with a secretary at the FA. We got tickets from there. We got very good seats.
But going back to the Chelsea night, that's probably why it makes that even more special,
right.
Isn't it?
It was
a little bit like your final there.
Yeah, well, it was. I genuinely thought we'd blown it after Heysel was such an awful experience. The way it was thought of in the media and what, the way that English clubs and Liverpool in particular were vilified after that was just unbelievable. People say to me to this day about Heysel or Hillsborough, and I always say the same thing. Were you there? No, I said, I was in the middle of all that at the Heysel. The PA box at the Heysel Stadium was in the corner, quite low down, but in the Italian end. And you can imagine how much fun I had getting out of there. It was, I was on the plane on the way home. I said, I'm just going to burn my passport again. I'm just never going abroad ever again. I just can't contemplate it. But we got through.
Time is catching up on us. Just quickly, what are the most significant things you've ever had to announce in Anfield that perhaps aren't football related?
Oh, well, obviously, minute silences when things have happened. When Shankly died, that was one that sticks in my mind. When Princess Diana died, that was another, quite an occasion. But on a lighter side, my favourite story, in the 80s, I think, we were playing Bolton Wanderers in the League Cup, and they were in the old, I think they were in the third division at the time, and there was one guy, Bolton fan, whose wife was expecting, and she was nearly going into labour, and it was time for him to get on the coach and come to Anfield. And all his life he'd wanted to see his beloved Bolton play at Anfield and Old Trafford and whatever. So he had the decision to make. So, of course, he gets on the coach. So at half-time, I had to announce to this guy, he was now the proud father of a bouncing baby boy.
Bless.
Absolutely. Because people forget that there were noble mobile phones in the 80s. That was so. If he got a message to somebody, it was Muggins here who had to pass it on. It's priceless.
George, you've been spreading happiness in Anfield for 47 years. I'm sure you'll reach the 50, beyond as well. But thank you very much indeed for your company tonight. My
pleasure, Steve.
Absolutely superb stuff. George Sefton with his Match of My Life.
Match of My Life: life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.